Blog Talk Radio.
Hi. In the swamps of Jersey. We turned it off before the sax man. Oh, well. I'm sorry, sax man. This is Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling for September 21st, the year 2015. It's a Monday. It's in the 6 p.m. Eastern Time half hour. This is Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling. And this is a Monday Night Football Monday for the Jets and the Colts. We will be joined in 5 minutes by the great Adam Helfgott, who is giving a worldwide radio exclusive on his thoughts on the Rutgers athletics scandal situation, fiasco, whatever you want to call it. Whatever you want to call it, he'll be here to discuss it, and that comes up in a couple minutes. I don't have a good feeling about the Jets. I told you that with Luke Morrow yesterday on the Sunday Sprint. I just don't, so we'll see what happens tonight, but I just feel like we may find out that the Colts are the team that really wants it more, and that's what I think will happen tonight with the Colts winning this game. I don't have a prediction of score, but I do think the Colts will win this game, and I'll be very pleasantly surprised if the Jets do win this game. Jason Day is your new number one player in the world. He won the BMW Championship yesterday, Conway Farms, outside of Chicago. Big win for Jason, who is on an absolute roll, 102 under par. He's some major number under par since, or maybe it is 102 under par. Maybe that was from Friday. Whatever it is, Jason's 10,000 strokes better than everybody else right now. He's eclipsed Rory and Jordan Spieth for number one in the world. Now you get into an interesting territory on if Jordan will be number on if Jordan will be the player of the year, or by the time we get to the player of the year voting, which happens literally Monday. So Tour Championship by Coca-Cola this week, and then we get to Monday morning, and all the ballots are sent out for player of the year, rookie of the year, etc. I don't know who rookie of the year will be. If Daniel Berger somehow wins this week, I think he puts a face to it, potentially. I still think it's Justin Thomas. I don't think Tony Finau did enough in the playoffs. Berger's the only rookie to make it to Eastlake. I don't think Nick Taylor, who was the other rookie to win, I don't think he did enough for the rest of the year. He really had an inconsistent year, which can happen. You know, you punch your ticket to the big time, and sometimes, you know, you can relax and take a breather, and that's what happened with Nick Taylor, which there's nothing wrong with it. He just didn't have a good year besides his one victory at Sanderson Farms. And I think when it comes to rookie of the year, I think Justin Thomas has been better and more consistent, and I think he'll win that. Player of the year for me, and we'll talk about this either next week or the week after, I have always been of the opinion that majors count. Maybe it's because I'm from the Tiger era. Maybe that's because 18 has been golf's magical number along with 59 my whole lifetime. But what Jack did and Tiger shooting for Jack said something to me. And that's why I was looking at majors. Jordan Spieth is two majors. Jason Day is one major. And two beats one, and no matter what Jason does, even if he wins the FedEx Cup, if he wins, the Tour Championship, no matter what happens, and obviously he controls his destiny along with Jordan, Ricky, Henrik, and I believe Bubba Watson. Browser is giving an error for reasons I'm not sure of. Hold on a second. This is weird. By the browsers do weird things sometimes. Well, we'll have to deal with that later because Adam Helfgott's going to call in momentarily. I'll give you the five on the FedEx Cup after this break. Bob Costas right now, PSA, then Adam Helfgott to talk Rutgers. We'll be right back. This is Teeing It Up on Blog Talk Radio, Golf News Net Radio Network, and iTunes.
Sometimes tough isn't enough. Lou Gehrig was baseball's Iron Man, but lost it all to ALS, a muscle-wasting disease that destroyed his skills and ended his life in just a few years. MDA has been leading the fight to vanquish ALS for decades. Truly effective treatments must be found, because the battle Lou Gehrig fought is still being waged in households across America. Call 1-800-572-1717 to learn more about what MDA is doing to strike out ALS and save lives.
The Rutgers University alum, he's a guy that cares a lot about that university through and through. We welcome back to Teeing It Up, Mr. Adam Helfgott. Hello, sir.
Hey, what's up there, Mr. Schilling? How you doing?
I'm good. It's stunning. I said this to our pal, Mr. Breslauer, today. I said it's stunning that you said yes to the invitation.
Well, you know, once in a while, I guess, you know, you can make a glorious return. If we want to call it that. So, hey, why not? Why not? If things are crumbling all around, I'm all for it. Let's dive into it.
You've not been happy with Rutgers for many reasons for a while, but this, I think, has angered you, sent you over the edge, sent a lot of people over the edge. Let's go basic, and then we'll delve down further. Should Kyle Flood be the Rutgers football head coach right now?
Well, I think you can look at it from a couple different angles. If you want to talk first about, you know, the transgressions off the field, then simply you could start with what happened with Nadir Barnwell and the email fiasco, basically taking a page out of Hillary Clinton's book. I think that in that circumstance, in my opinion, Kyle seemed to be extremely egregious, extremely carefree when it came to knowing what the rules are, or at least in his sake, it seemed like he knew what the rules were, and then he had no regard for them whatsoever, and then pretty much lying about it for an extended period of time. I mean, if you just look at it from that angle, I don't think it pleases many Rutgers fans, at least the level-headed ones, the ones that, you know, want to say that it's not a big deal and every school does it. I don't think those are, you know, people that have their priorities in order regardless. If you're asking me my opinion on that, the email alone to me is cause for his termination.
As you look at it, this is clearly somebody that did not know the rules that were in place. Is this somebody who's trying to win too hard and win at all costs in a new conference where there was clearly a difference in talent level last year?
Well, I think that if you look at it, one, again, going back to did he or did he not know the rules? I mean, I think it's pretty clear from the email that whether or not he was aware of the rules up front, he was eventually told them and still disregarded them. So I think that's as big of a no-no as you could have, and then doing it in the way he did, basically leaving a paper trail or an electronic paper trail, again, is dumbfounding, and you almost kind of laugh at the stupidity of it. As far as whether or not he's in over his head or is Rutgers in over their heads, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that Rutgers is in over their heads in many aspects in the jump that they've made to the Big Ten, whether it be athletically, whether it's fundraising, talent on the field. I mean, there's a lot of issues right now, and basically Rutgers was handed a lottery ticket, and it seems like they really don't know what to do with their winnings.
You've talked a lot about that, and I'm glad that you brought that up because that's kind of where I wanted to go with this. So we'll get to that in a second because you've had issues with facilities and with commitment from the president's office on down and all that. So we'll get to that in a second. Next up is player discipline. And I know from having covered the Monmouth football team for several years, there is nothing that drives a coach nuts besides not doing their job on field, then misbehaving off the field. And Rutgers has seen a ridiculous rash of arrests and suspensions and discipline issues here right before the season, after the season started. A, whose buck does this fall down? And B, what the heck is happening here?
Well, I hope they get, some good TV in any of the jail cells because they may be watching some more football games from there. But in all honesty, I think that you can look at it again in a couple different ways. I mean, at the end of the day, these are still 18 to 22-year-olds for the most part, some who come from very difficult backgrounds, who aren't taught really, truly right from wrong throughout their entire lives. And, sometimes you make really, really stupid decisions. I can't speak to exactly what happened in all these cases. I mean, the home invasions, I mean, that's beyond despicable and something that, you can't tolerate no matter what human you are. You shouldn't be accepting of that. The other incidents where it seems like there was some type of physical altercation, whether it was provoked or unprovoked, again, something as a football player you should just be aware of. Hey, you're a prime target on campus, and, you should think better. You got a lot more to lose, and these kids aren't taught that. Or at least they aren't comprehending that, it seems. As far as whose shoulders it falls on, sure, it starts with the head coach. I mean, Kyle Flood, whether or not, I don't need him to hold these kids' hands every night they go out, but, he should be setting rules and players should be respecting him. Now, the issue is that if Kyle Flood can't behave off the field, what makes you think that his players are going to, behave off the field as well? And I think that's where you're seeing some issues right now. The Leonte Carew thing specifically, again, I think it's a little bit of an outlier. It's a very odd situation. If you read deeply into the details, I think that is an outlier case. I think the other guys were guys that were given second chances by Coach Flood that probably shouldn't have been giving second chances, and they've proven why they shouldn't have been given second chances. And as a coach, when those kids mess up and screw up, it's going to fall on your shoulders. And it does not help when you don't win on the field if you're going to have these issues off the field.
Talking with Adam Helfgott here about the mess at Rutgers. What fascinates me about this, though, is that it's and yes, it some are outliers and some are second chance guys who messed up, but this seems like thing after thing after thing after thing. At some point, don't the team leaders, don't the guys, don't the captains, don't the guys who were given responsibility for a reason need to step up and say, look, what the heck is going on here? That's what is so appalling to me, is that it seems like the culture, even beyond Kyle Flood, but the player culture, the looking after each other, taking care of each other culture failed here.
Listen, your biggest issue is that two of the four captains have been guys that have run into the issues. Your starting quarterback was caught with a fake ID going into a bar. Leonte Carew was, suspended for the first half of the Norfolk State game because of breaking curfew before his incident happened where he was indefinitely suspended. So to start this season, you had two of your four captains suspended for the first half of a football game, or should I say one of the captains and then the quarterback. Either way, it's not a good sign when two of the most important people on the team, clearly something is awry there. Again, whether it's because people think Kyle Flood is too lenient and he's the anti-Greg Schiano, it's very possible. Again, I'm not as plugged into the situation as I once was when covering this team in college, but, the ideas that I get and from what I've heard, I mean, I think it's a little bit of a product of a lenient head coach who maybe is a little bit too much in over his head right now, being in charge of a big-time Division I program when he really has never had that experience before.
Now let's talk facilities. You guys went to a new conference. You were just at Happy Valley this past weekend. You saw what big-time Big Ten football has. Why does it seem like Rutgers has been in slow motion when it comes to upgrading facilities?
That's a loaded question, and they would probably take, 10 episodes to go through each thing. I mean, the gist of it, I'll try and break it down as simply as possible, is that for decades, Rutgers has been behind the eight ball in big-time athletics. Rutgers really never made a commitment to big-time athletics until the late 90s, early 2000s, really the early 2000s, when Bob Mulcahy was the AD at the time and when Greg Schiano was brought in. That's when you saw a commitment to football. I mean, Rutgers a long time ago was, as an example, was invited to join the Big East Conference for basketball and originally turned it down out of stupidity. Again, Rutgers was uncommitted at the time to major athletics. Again, Rutgers was handed a lottery ticket right now. The fact is that it doesn't have a fan base like Penn State or Ohio State or Michigan. It doesn't have the endowment of those schools, and it doesn't have the history of, you know, alumni giving significant donations. At the end of the day, the New Jersey government is going to always refuse to truly go in deep and empty their pockets for Rutgers, even though it's the State University of New Jersey, and it's going to fall on the alumni. Now, the alumni probably aren't going to donate when you have, it seems at least, incompetent people leading the university, whether it's the president or the athletic director, or if they're unhappy about the football coach. So, again, it's a loaded question. It starts with the fact that they don't have a large donation base because of the alumni group, but it also doesn't help that it seems like the leadership has also failed Rutgers.
And then you have another issue, which is that your football team is not playing very good football. You lose, I don't know how you lost the game to Washington State, and then you go in there to Penn State and get blasted by a team that frankly hadn't impressed a lot of people and had an offensive line that was shaky at best. What is happening?
Well, I think you're seeing kind of, this is really the, you know, last year you saw it a little bit, and this year I think you see it with, you know, Coach Flood. This is his program now. These are mainly his kids. You know, I would have to go through the roster. I can't imagine there's no more than a handful of guys left over from the Schiano regime. And, you know, recruiting has suffered. He hasn't done a great job there, and that's what's evident. The talent gap between Rutgers and the top echelon of the Big Ten teams is just way too drastic. And Penn State is not a top echelon Big Ten team anymore, so it's even more concerning with the performance over this past weekend. Again, I think it comes down to, you know, X's and O's you can debate a little bit. You know, I've got my opinions on what I think is right and wrong to do on a football team with the personnel that you have. But at the end of the day, it's going to come down to talent. And right now, this is not a program that has quality Big Ten talent, plain and simple.
You're in an interesting spot because you've seen this team. You know, you were there for Pandemonium on the Piscataway. You were on that field that night. It must seem like that's, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, passed by now. This has got to be a frustrating stretch for you guys.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt. Again, you know, I always, you know, people kind of look at me like when I'm crazy when I say this. You know, and I don't know, if I had the opportunity to sit down with Big Ten Commissioner Jim Delaney, I'd ask him, you know, how much did 2006 truly play a role in getting Rutgers to the Big Ten? And I don't have that answer, but because I don't have that answer, I'll preface it this way. That night and that season in 2006 may be one of the worst things, in a sense, to happen to Rutgers football because it kind of rushed the process a little bit. And it set expectations very high for a program and a university that really hadn't built the foundation yet. And, you know, you want to use the house example, you can't build a house without the foundation. And Rutgers was kind of forced to just put something up and build it as greatly and as impressive and as quickly as possible without really doing things the right way. And, you know, yes, it's long ago. I mean, this November it'll be 9 years since Rutgers beat Louisville. And they really haven't capitalized on it. They never won an outright Big East championship, and now they're in a conference where it reminds me of the early Schiano days in Big East conference where you had Virginia Tech and Miami that were kind of the top echelon. I think you're seeing that with the Ohio State and Michigan State this year. Then you have some really, really good middle teams, and you have a few bottom dwellers. And that used to be you know, where Rutgers was with Temple, and I think Rutgers has kind of fallen back into that spot. Now into the Temple, it's Rutgers, Illinois, and Purdue maybe at the bottom.
What infuriates you more, Rutgers basketball or the Mets handling of Matt Harvey?
listen, I think the more curious thing right now and the more relevant thing is Matt Harvey. I don't think, you know, what Rutgers does basketball-wise, they've been inept for decades. I think this is more frustrating for Mets fans like myself right now who kind of can taste the postseason and what we should be focusing on or not, because you're going to have to deal with almost a sideshow right now.
I'm speechless just sitting here thinking about what the heck has happened with Matt Harvey here. it's almost like you can't win because if I was the Mets, I would pitch Matt Harvey two innings and then say goodbye because you want him for the playoffs. You want him full out for the playoffs. This is like stuck in the middle of nowhere. I would go all the way back and make it like spring training and just throw him two innings and say adios. Last night is like Temptation Island. It was a great show on Fox, or sorry, not a great show. It was a show. It got canceled. It was highly controversial, and everybody agreed the idea stunk. It's like you're tempting, and then you want them to go further, but you don't want them to go further, and you can't get all the parties to agree, and this just seems to be headed towards utter disaster.
Well, we'll have to see. I think if the Mets can play well in the series, and they should, you know, they're capable of sweeping the Braves, and if they do, I think it'll quiet the rumors or the, you know, fear of a collapse. As long as that National Series at the end is meaningless, then I think what you're going to see is the Mets are going to go to Matt Harvey and say, listen, we're in this mess right now, but we're going to win the division. You tell us what you need to feel comfortable. Is it a pitch count? Is it an innings limit? Whatever it is, we're going to do it so that you've got rhythm going into the playoffs. Listen, Pandora's box is open. Matt Harvey and Scott Boras made the mistake of going public at the wrong time, and you know Matt stuck his neck out there in a very bad situation by talking to the media and not being well prepared. And, you know, the New York media jumped all over it. You know, if this was something that was done behind closed doors, you know, we're not talking about it right now. The Mets could be figuring this out in peace while trying to win a division. As far as what you do now, I think you just got to go and please Matt Harvey and ask him what he truly wants to do. And then you kind of take it from there. It's going to have to be a game-by-game basis now because of the way it was handled when it was first leaked out.
Do you honestly believe that the Mets will go far in the playoffs?
I don't. If you're asking, do I think they need a 1,000% healthy Matt Harvey to go deep into the playoffs? No. Especially if they can wind up playing well the rest of the way and wind up with home field advantage in the first round. If I'm the Mets, I don't want to face Greinke and Kershaw on the road in the shadows at Chavez Ravine. But if you get them home, and I have a strange feeling that although you may be seeing, quote-unquote unhealthy or fatigued Matt Harvey now, I think he'll be fine for his one game in the DS if they get there. I think Jacob deGrom is a little bit of a bigger concern right now. And if they could pitch Noah Syndergaard at home in the playoffs, I would not be too concerned right now as a Mets fan. I think they are just as good, if not better, than they would be matching up against the Dodgers.
Adam Helfgott with us. Adam, let's see. The world, if the World Series goes to Game 7, it would be, what, November 4th, I think it is? 3rd, something like that?
You probably Yeah, roughly.
Yeah. Come November 4th, will A, the Mets have won the World Series, B, Kyle Flood have been fired as coach of the Rutgers Scarlet Knights, or C, both? Or none.
I was gonna throw D out there and say none right now. I can't be too confident. Again, a week from now, depending on how the Mets are playing, that may change my tune. I thought a couple weeks ago, they were the best team in baseball, and it gave you that hope. As far as Rutgers goes, since we started with that and can finish basically with that too, I don't foresee Rutgers firing Kyle Flood midseason. It doesn't. Past history at Rutgers will tell you that's not how they do things. I think that, you know, they'll probably finish roughly between 3 and 5 wins this season. And I would bet to say that Kyle Flood will probably not be the coach in 2016, but I do not see an early exit for 2015. They had their opportunity with the email fiasco. If that wasn't going to get it done, then I don't think the on-field performance is what's going to get it done as far as him losing his job during the season.
You have an open forum here. Is there anything else you'd like to vent about before we say goodbye?
No. Maybe we'll get a return appearance if Rutgers makes some hard line decisions in the near future. But I certainly enjoyed it as always, my man.
Great to have you on, Mr. Helfgott. It's an honor. It's a privilege. It's a pleasure. It's a privilege. I know every time I have you on the show, I've somehow convinced you to say yes, so it's a minor miracle. So thank you for appearing, and enjoy the rest of your night. And, hey, maybe you will get change at Rutgers in a Mets World Series title. You never know.
You never know. You gotta stay positive. I appreciate it, my man. Take care.
Take care. That's Adam Helfgott, ladies and gentlemen. He's a good man. The top five of the FedEx Cup standings is indeed Day, Spieth, Ricky, Stenson, and Bubba Watson. Those five control their own destiny. If any of those five win the Tour Championship, they have won $10 million in the FedEx Cup. Somebody will walk away with $11.3 million. On Sunday on the National Broadcasting Company, we will find out who that is this week. I'd like to thank Adam Helfgott. I'd like to thank everybody who made this program possible, and we'll see you next week. Have a great night, everybody, and remember, you can listen to any episode on archive. blogtalkradio.com/Jeremy3162 and iTunes. Search Teeing It Up or Jeremy Schilling in the bio. We'll see you Sunday, 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time for the Sunday Sprint alongside Luke Morrow. Take care. Have a good night, everybody. Bye-bye.